race. So just some background, particularly for those of you, if you haven't been to a CWA panel yet this year, each panelist in this particular this type of panel will be given up to 8 minutes, up to 8 minutes for their opening comments.
And then we get the hook.
And then,
no.
Up to, because we want to make sure that we have as much interaction as possible. So they'll be given up to 8 minutes. There may be a question I will pose at the end of that for one or more of them to respond to. And then we want audience participation. We will not be using the app because I could not figure it out. Okay. We will be doing old school,
yes.
So the note cards. So the producers in the rooms, if the producers, if you could raise your hands so that it's the two folks at the back there, they have cards and they'll come and so come through and hand those to you, and you can write down a question for the panelists, and I will shift through them. Obviously, we probably won't be able to get to all the questions, but I'll sift through those. Students will have some priority with this, so if you are a student, please be sure to mark on your card that you are a student here at CU. So let's get started. My name is Hillary Potter. I'm the moderator for this panel, the moderator only. This is an area of expertise of mine. First of all, I'm a resident of Denver, lifelong resident. I am an alum from CU Boulder, twice over in sociology, bachelor's and PhD. I am a black feminist criminologist. I study crime, violence, et cetera, et cetera. And I am an associate professor here at CU Boulder in the Department of Ethnic Studies. We have on our panel today James Bell. Ellen Sweets. Deliana Garcia.
¡Que viva!
And Joe Saxton.
Pulitzer Prize winning Joe Saxton.
So Joe was swapped in for Shodeka, who is not here with us today.
We're mirror images of each other.
So we are going to start with the opening comments up to 8 minutes with Joe and then go down the line.
Oh, Lord. Good afternoon. This is my second year coming, I've made something of a habit of sort of pushing the boundaries of appropriateness. I swear a lot. I came up with the Sex with Robots panel idea. So in the spirit of being being inappropriate, I'm going to say that I dreaded coming to this panel. When I saw James and Del sitting in the green room, I kind of sat down and said, you know, I can't do this. And I described myself as brokenhearted. Let's talk about race. Really? Again? To what end? It's a brokenheartedness that I think a lot of people feel. I don't know about the other panelists. Are they going to be smarter and likely more hopeful than me? But I look back, so I'm fucking 57. Lived a life not particularly remarkable or virtuous. But one in a family pretty committed to justice and to mutual respect. I'm one of seven in an Irish Catholic family, with the seventh having been a tiny African-American infant child, daughter, that my parents adopted in 1970 in Brooklyn, which seems a little less remarkable today than it did then. But it was quite a thing in Irish, Italian, ethnic, Catholic Brooklyn in the day. I went on at my first job in journalism, was as the lone white reporter on a African-American weekly newspaper in Brooklyn. It was a wonderful adventure, and we felt very convinced of our valor. It's called the City Sun, speaking truth to power. What the fuck I was doing there, I have no idea. But there's something that felt, good and worthy about the effort. I've gone on to run a couple of big departments at big American newspapers and have earned a good reputation for trying to hire diverse staff. My sister Kate's married to an African, wonderful African American man. Again, people are probably wincing, like, you know, it's like, oh, this is what every white person says. I have friends who are black. You know, I have relatives who are black. And again, so I want to make clear, I don't say this because I think it established me as somebody particularly remarkable or committed, but it is across my life. I think reflective of a hope that things could be better, that we could solve some of the issues of race in America. But I don't think we can. That makes me incredibly sad, scared. I was telling Del and James that I read everything Ta-Nehisi Coates has written of late, and it's great and bracing and powerful and in some ways very dispiriting, at least by my view. But I can't argue with them anymore. I think it's right. He wrote a piece for The Atlantic at the end of the year. He got to spend some time with Obama, who he had been quite tough on during his presidency. And they talked about a whole variety of things and the question of reparations. It was a very mournful piece. I went straight from there to go see, I Am Not Your Negro. And there's James Baldwin, and I'm like, oh, Christ, we've not moved an inch. Which is probably not true, and yet probably true enough. So, to get this off to a rousing start, to the extent this kind of weird confession has any utility, it may set folks here on the panel up to talk back to that, and if they feel the same way or if they feel hope, I'm in the mood for hope. So, thank you.
I'm not sure that I can say I feel enormously hopeful, but I don't think I feel hopeless on the other side. There's no choice but to keep moving forward, putting one foot in front of the other. What the hell are you going to do otherwise? So when I was asked to come and do this and I read the little topic, which was only very recently, and then I found out that I was going to be on the same panel today with Ellen and James, to think about race and how I move through the world. And I think to myself, it's like standing in an ice floe, and you got one foot on one piece and one foot on another, and they're diverging. And you're trying like hell to pull the two pieces together. Because there's, you know, there's the racial stuff that you see out in the world at the higher level, and the structural violence that I witness every day and the people that I work with and for are experiencing on a daily basis. And then there's my personal experience of race and how I move through every day of that. And so on one level, working hard and feeling that I can affect something, and then realizing that in the next minute, someone can say something to me that turns me into a gelatinous mess. And then I have to say that right now, this year, following this election, I am more afraid for myself personally than I have been in the 60 years I've been alive. And so when I reflect, though, on what has allowed me to keep moving forward, you know, I was a border kid. I grew up in El Paso. There were a lot of Mexicans there. We were everywhere. And we kind of moved back and forth, and it was not such a big deal. And so I went on to a really great school. I was educated by religious. The Jesuits were like, we don't care what you believe. You just have to be able to articulate it, cite your sources, defend it to the death, and keep moving forward. And that has served me enormously well. And the only time I've been part of the 1%, I was part of the 1% that UT in Austin was required to bring forward in minority students after they'd lost a 10-year fight to say that minority across the entire system was all they needed to do. And after 10 years, the court said, no, you know what, 1% in Austin. So me and 400 of my closest friends showed up. We embraced one another when we passed. And I continued to go. So I think about now professionally, you know, and where people are currently, that it becomes a question then of how I focus in the world and how I live my life. And now I have my son. And so I watch him as a young man. Now, you know, he's got an Irish dad. So I have to be honest and say that the evening came when he was out really late and I wasn't sure what was going on, and that mom fear rose up, and I was both sort of stunned and grateful that I thought to myself, but you know, he looks kind of white. And so, okay, you use what's in front of you, you see what is really there, and then you fight the good fight. And so when I look at my work side of this and I see what's going up for people and we look at race, what I struggle against on a daily basis is that somehow now in my work, race is connected to deservingness. And I was recently at a conference where, you know, I've been working in infectious disease for 30 years now and the effect of migration on health. And I was at a conference, and I was at an opening session from the WHO, and, you know, we were waxing poetic about the new equity document that WHO just put out. And, you know, the evening was starting to end, and they were taking questions from the floor, and someone stood up who's, you know, the head of a TB program, and she was saying, you know, in TB, we just need to get our people who are affected by TB to mobilize. You know, we need to take a page from HIV. They need to be as effective in advocating for themselves as people were with HIV. And I tolerated it for about 7 minutes, maybe. And then I was like a woman with her hair on fire. And I just like got up and I said, well, one, not to be rude, but HIV, the people affected by HIV were white. They had money. They had education. They had access to power. They understood how it worked. And they had the sense that they deserved for the system to respond to them. Now let's look at TB. And people with TB are generally brown or black. They're poor. Limited education, few resources, and are told repeatedly that they do not deserve what little they've gotten. Now, you want that group to rise up and make your job at the WHO and everywhere else you work easier, because they're going to advocate on their own behalf. Not going to happen, and I'm not going to put my energy into that. So when we get to this whole discussion of race, and I can't be hopeful, sorry, but on the other hand, do I keep moving forward? Absolutely. Am I angry? You bet. Do I use that anger? Hopefully, as positively and effectively as possible. And I remember years and years ago, there was a wonderful book written called Cold Anger. And they said, hot anger consumes you, and you get lost to the fight. But cold anger keeps you going, and it lives in the belly. And you keep putting one foot in front of the other, and you are not consumed. You are just as effective as you can possibly be. And so, while not hopeful, I'm not going to give up. Thank you.
My name is Ellen Sweets. I am a woman of color. I come from a newspaper family, and I grew up being taught that the most powerful way to influence a community is through the printed word. My father was death on wheels about education, as was my mother, who graduated from Howard University. My father has had a business degree. Her father was a chemist. We lived in, I'm 76 years old, so when I was growing up, we lived in segregated neighborhoods. So it didn't matter whether or not your father owned a newspaper, as my father did, or drove a taxi cab, or picked up garbage, or went to work as a nurse, a doctor, or a lawyer. You all lived in the same neighborhood. We did not have the option until the 60s to move to where we wanted to live, where we could afford to live. And so my father, in founding his newspaper, based it on the importance of education. And my way of exercising what he taught was through the printed word. And I have always tried to write about those segments of the community that people don't know about, specifically the black middle class. There is a notion among way too many people that if you're black, you're an athlete, an entertainer, an actor, or a criminal. And my focus in writing has been to look at the people who do all the things that everyone else, anyone else does, and say, you need to know who these people are. You need to not make judgments based on your very limited experience. And I must also warn everyone in the audience, do not come up to me and say, when I was growing up, we had a black caregiver, and she was just like my mother. She was a member of the family. No, she wasn't. Unless you invited her to dinner at Christmas and Thanksgiving, unless you had your kids had pajama parties that included her kids, unless her kids had pajama parties that invited yours, no, it wasn't the same. And this is what is so dishonest about the conversation about race. For one thing, we rarely know how to talk about it. And we don't read that much about it. When I was growing up, my grandfather would come to dinner on Sunday, and he would give us a nickel if we had memorized a short poem. He'd give us a dime if we'd memorized a long one. And in my one solitary moment as a savant, memorized a piece from South Pacific. My parents took us to New York once a year to see a play and a musical. And I walked out of South Pacific having memorized and having only heard it once, a song. And some of you know what it is. You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made, of people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. Let's talk.
Thank you all for coming. I want to say, add my good afternoon and thank my fellow panelists. I want to take a moment of personal privilege. This will be my last panel. I've been on, this will be my sixth. I've been on three yesterday and three today. And it has just been, this is my first time here, and this has just been a joy. I want to thank publicly Ellen for giving the committee my name, and I want to thank all of you who have come up to me in the hallways after we speak to say what you said was interesting, and it looked like you meant it. And so I never quite know, but, you know. And the people that I've met here, you know, getting to be arm-in-arm with a Pulitzer Prize-winning person from an organization that I really respect, and to be here with Deliana and Ellen has been a wonderful thing for me to be away. So I want to just thank this experience. It was something that I have not had in many years. So thank you. In conversations about race, like Dell, that gave us the, you know, the iceberg with two, you know, that's splitting apart, I'm often torn, and most of us that are the other, most of us that are people of color, this is what people can't know, is this is every day of your life. And, you know, I have people come up to me and go, how can you not be mad all the time? And I say, there are some people who are. They cannot control their rage. It's not their fault because they've been forced to have to deal with rage. You manage it. And America gives you plenty reasons to manage it almost daily. So I always have to, I'm torn between engaging the meta-analysis of structural racism, or working at the micro level and doing as Dell described and Ellen has described, what you can to get it right now. And Joe opened us up beautifully, I think, with that. Both approaches have merit. It's not an either or. Why? Like Ellen, I grew up in Louisiana, in Virginia, during Jim Crow. So I lived through America's apartheid, which it's so funny that Americans won't say apartheid. It was Jim Crow, whatever the hell that is, right? But South Africa, oh, that was apartheid. But this, I grew up in apartheid, and I learned the importance of the broader picture, the meta, and its impact on my day-to-day life. It would have been foolish of me to believe that the reason that the grocery store that I went to was segregated was because it was close to my home. That is the personal versus the structural. Well, why is it segregated? Because it's close. No, it's because it's segregated by law. One of our nation's architects, and he happens to be my favorite, one of my favorites, because he's such a friggin' mess, John Adams. John Adams was the blunt speaker of his time, while Thomas Jefferson was flowering everything up with freedom and independence while I'm having slaves. John Adams was just straight down the line. And John Adams said, power always thinks it has a great soul. Power always thinks it has a great soul. So everything the founders did was great because they had a great soul. Root causes are particularly difficult to engage because in our society that manifests itself racially and ethnically. Because of the unresolved contradictions all these years later involved in our birth as a nation that play out every day in our lives. That contradiction is that the founders of this nation in this experiment in democracy, which was revolutionary in its time, they were simultaneously creating a nation. And make no mistake about it, they were creating a racial identity as well. The nation was committed to the idea of freedom of from tyranny of royalty and democratic principles, while the racial identity was a formula for power and exclusion. The result made Protestant, male, whiteness itself a source of power to control every form that subsequently came of the other. And what were those other forms that came? Catholicism, Jews, women, immigrants, etc., all to be the other and not to be hegemonically in control. So this initial contradiction of freedom, oppression, and race and privilege is the centerpiece, I believe, of Race Matters to this day. And while it is difficult to hear, and why Joe doesn't want to talk about it, we cannot wish it away, and we will have continuing flare-ups and blowback as long as we never resolve this contradiction, and it is not resolved. There is so much privileged, willful ignorance about this dilemma. It is a privilege to be willfully ignorant about the conditions that this country has imposed. So let me just bring it to you since we're talking about race. In my house, it's called 400 Years of Free Labor on Stolen Land. That just don't get you misty-eyed about the flag. And I'm not Native American on a reservation at Lakota trying to rationalize my existence about water in 2017. I'm not part of the Oklahoma Sooners. We hear this totally different. Because we can't be willfully ignorant because we are it. So, what do we know? We know that we have been subject to willful ignorance in this country about cranial measurements to determine levels of intelligence. Oh, yes. Read the new book, The Gene, to talk about eugenics and what it has done to communities of color. Pseudoscience claiming the biological certainty of the inferiority of Asians, Latinos, Native Americans, and people of African descent. Science, and I might move you forward to Wilson and Herrnstein. Criminal justice and nature. Ectomorphic, mesomorphic. We can look at your brain, we can look at you and determine that you are a criminal, and what is crime prevention? Sterilization. More recently, research has shown that in many widely read books and newspapers, the word black is most frequently paired with words like poor, violent, religious, lazy, cheerful. Oh, we're lazy and cheerful at the same time. Thank you, Chicken George. And dangerous. The word white, on the other hand, is most often linked with words such as wealthy, progressive, conventional, stubborn, successful, and educated. And as our Latino, Asian, Native American, and LGBTQ family are included in this research, I'm sure there will be similar word associations for them as well, and they will not be positive. It must be asked, what is it about the American experience where race and ethnicity live so deeply in our institutional fabric? Americans have not talked about race, as Joe suggested, since the country's inception. Some of the results have been positive, others less so. But indeed, Americans' feelings about race are demonstrated not in what people say, but in what they do. I have a saying, intelligence isn't something you have, it's something you do. You could be smart as hell and stupid as the day is long. And where people have exercised their choice, not what they say, but what they do, where they have exercised their choice, housing, schools. Our society is as segregated now as it has much as it's always been, even when I was living in Jim Crow, resulting not in that overused term. This is the fantasy that people have not come to grips with. not that overused term, melting pot, but more akin to what Dell and I like to eat, dim sum. Like, these are just different trades coming around. This ain't no melting pot, okay? So as Melody Hobson told us in her TED Talk, what we need as a nation is to be color brave, not color blind. I can't tell you how many people come up to me and they go, I don't see color. And I go, okay, so describe who spoke to you today. Are you going to say that? Well, there was this white guy from San Francisco that talked to me. I doubt it. But I know what that instinct is. I know what they're trying to say. But colorblind is not where we are. Color brave is where we need to be.
Nice.
So as we devolved from the meta to the micro, I keep the words of Eleanor Roosevelt, one of my heroines, close to my heart. She posited that universal rights of all humans begin in small places, close to homes, which are mostly segregated. Such are places where man, woman, and child seek equal justice, equal opportunity, and equal dignity. Thus, at this level, the micro level, you do best, I believe, by examining right here as you sit here, in 20 seconds of reflection while I'm talking, your own sense of fairness and dignity towards others, and what have you done when you've exercised choice. And if that takes, and if that journey takes you into one that Joe is totally reasonable in believing, that is a zero-sum racial game, that if I, as someone white, lose something to somebody of color, then I have lost and they win. If you do the zero-sum racial game, then we will continue to use race in this country as a proxy for power. Because that's what it is. Mm-hmm. This is an individual decision. And in the upcoming America, I won't be here for it. But some of these young people, Professor Potter, some of the people in your class, they will. And let me just say, I'm not so trustworthy that these millennials are not as race conscious as their parents. I know that that's the publicity they get. They're millennials, they like everybody. Yeah, but I ain't seen privilege given up easily. So I'll wait and see about our millennial, multiracial, multi-ethnic, we eat sushi, great people, and see how privilege plays out in the issues of race in their future. It'll play out differently from the issues of race for those of us baby boomers. But this is America, and it will play out. And so we will see how millennials figure out, because what I will suggest to you is there is not a technology fix for this. And so how we resolve this issue will determine, as John Adams says, if power does have a great soul.
I told you it gave better.
Powerful, powerful narrative from each of the panelists. There are note cards going around. That would be great if you have questions to get those filled out so that I could get those. James started to talk about this and answer the question that I have for you all until we get some audience questions. So if each of you could answer this question here.
Yes.
And again, James, you started to get to it.
Thank you.
Whose job is it to make race no longer a problem in the United States? And what does that job entail?
I think that's a personal job. And it is a job that requires discomfort and displacement, personally. Because you cannot do what you've done. And, you know, that's what I really appreciate, Joe, what you call the confessional. Because it was so real. I mean, what you went to is what people have as their measurement of how I'm doing in this race conversation. And so if you do what you do,
and actually you feel that you've reached the comfort zone with that, it is not going to get where we need to be, because personal manifests itself in policy. And to the degree that you can make yourself aware of how personal decisions are impacting the other, and therefore take it upon yourself to join with those communities, not lead those communities, join with those communities for equity and sharing power, then I think we are on our way. I'll just give one quick example. I am a big, since I've been doing this work on policy, I'm a big believer in what, in so much of what happens in American policy discussions. They start like now. It's like, well, this is what happened now. And I always like to go historically, because nothing just happens. When I was driving from the airport, I drove past some gigantic development while I was listening to my GPS called Broomfield. And I'm like, I don't know nothing about Boulder. I know less about Denver. But, oh, I know something about this. Just driving in, there's a lot of decisions to make Broomfield, Broomfield, about what that's going to be and who's going to live there. And so where I live in the Bay Area, in Oakland, in North Oakland, there's a neighborhood called Rock Ridge. And Rock Ridge is a neighborhood that many of the progressives, people who work for legal services, people who write books like Sweets, I mean, it's a great neighborhood, and people will say, I live in Rock Ridge, and we're a great neighborhood. Yes, but it's mostly white. It's progressive, but it's mostly white. So I went and looked in 1910, 1920 at the real estate pamphlets for Rock Ridge. It was a new development. Rock Ridge didn't always become Rock Ridge. It had to be Rock Ridge at some point. And it said, welcome to the new North Oakland development of Rock Ridge. We are right below the Claremont Hotel, close to golf courses. There will be no Negroes, no Japanese and Chinese that will be allowed to live here. And so then you follow that up with redlining, which Sweets can tell you about how, even though you fought in World War II, you cannot get a loan for a house for your middle class family. And you then are subjected to those policies. So the way we change this is that you personally are no longer willfully ignorant about those people. Anytime you live in a place where housing is segregated, say, what is going on here and what are the policies that I'm participating in? And every time you see somebody mad, burning down houses, burning down cars because of something that they think is unfair, don't say, why are those people doing that? Say, I wonder what it is that drove them to that. And let me actually not have a conversation about that. Let me go into that community and humble myself and talk to people to find out what they think we can do in partnership.
I'm just going to take a moment to disagree with you about millennials.
Okay.
Since I have one.
Good.
My daughter is 46. She's biracial. And it's so funny because until I got to the point where I'd look people straight in the eye and say exactly what I thought, when they would see us together, they would say, my goodness, she has blue eyes. And I said, well, funny you should mention that. I noticed that. And then they would say, is this your daughter? And I'd say,
yeah.
Apparently. And then they would say, was her father white?
Oh, God.
And I would say, he still is. The thing is, I've just come from a panel on comedy, so bear with me. But I think we're rarely aware of our prejudices. We are none of them without them. I cannot stand stupid people. I am so intolerant of ignorance, it's ridiculous. And for the longest time, I invested a lot of energy in explaining and accounting and trying to be conciliatory. But I know I have a soft voice, but you are looking at an angry black woman. I don't want to be. I have tried not to be. But it keeps being, I keep being pushed back into that place. And when you come to asking what can we do, see, I really believe most of us know what we can do. When you're walking down the street and you see five or six black kids walking toward you, don't cross over. Don't clutch your purse closer to you, because when I see five or six white kids walking toward me with tattoos and their appropriated hats turned backwards, I don't cross the street. I just look at them and say, okay, guys, make room for the old broad. And it throws them off guard. And so they step aside. But we have got to learn how to navigate this from both perspectives. Uh-huh. It can't keep being put on black people to help white people understand where the problems are. I think many, many know. It then becomes, what are you going to do about it? And that's what I would like to hear. I mean, I don't know if we're going to take questions from people here in the audience, but I want to know what people are willing to do to change this dynamic.
You know, so when I think about whose responsibility it is, right, you know, and what it is that can be done, and thinking about what both of you have said, and I think it's having people handle their presumptions, and that's the place where I'm mm-hmm. I'm just forever sort of, you know, dumbstruck, because I do a lot of public speaking and have for years, and invariably, God bless them, Alamo, someone will say to me, where are you from? And I'll say, I'm from Texas. Well, but before. Where were you from before? Nope. Always been from Texas. Was born in Texas. Well, where are your people from? Well, my people are from Earth and we come in peace. I don't know. So that
whole... Live long and prosper.
You're right. I'm down with it. So, and now at that juncture, any modicum of not wanting to just slap you till you stop breathing has left. And so that management of presumptions is the place where I get stuck. I don't know how to respond other than I do respond. I don't know how to respond to that secondary question, which then is just starting to piss me off. And then we get to the third question, and well, I don't want to talk anymore. So that is the place where I agree with that everyone's reflection, and it is not my responsibility. And I'm shoveling sand against the tide some days to do a good job my own self. And so I want to, but it is that management of presumptions that I don't know what to do.
I'm going to stay on my really upbeat note. But, you know, because it's really at the heart of my despair or whatever. But, you know, when Ellen, you know, asks the question, and I'll be eager to hear what people have to say, but what I would say to Ellen, and I think she knows it in her heart, question's been asked and answered again and again and again. And the answer is, what are people prepared to do? Not nearly fucking enough. And, you know, James and I were on a panel before this on police and civil rights. And, you know, and James, who's my new best friend, and just a wonderful, remarkable dude, you know, he can summon some, you know, reason for optimism about can we fix our police departments? Can we find, you know, find a way to both a safe and a just world? And it feels like, wow, that's a tall order, but maybe I can get with it. Maybe we can do that. But answering differently a question that's been asked and answered for centuries, it feels too daunting. It feels too settled. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that this adds to much, and I don't do this to, you know, continue to insult you good people. But like I came here to Boulder 38 years ago as a feckless, undisciplined, and clearly disoriented boy from Brooklyn. And it felt toxic to me. And at the center of the toxicity was Boulder's whiteness. I spent an unhappy couple of years, got locked up a couple times and left, and came back last year. Same place. And I don't mean that to insult people or to say you're bad people, but like, you know, shocking whiteness.
Okay, to continue with Joe, this is a question from a student. Just for you to elaborate a bit more. I'll try to read this without my readers. By proclaiming that as a nation we are unable to resolve the overwhelming racial issue, do you understand that you are telling all white people that they are stuck in a system that offers them great social, economic, political advantage? And that you are telling all people of color that we are stuck in a system that offers us incredible social, economic, and political disadvantage? And those were both framed as questions. They're written kind of rhetorical, but if you could respond to them.
Well, let me respond rhetorically. By proclaiming that as a nation we are unable to resolve the overwhelming racial issue, do you understand that you are telling all white people that they are stuck in the system that offers them great social, economic, political advantage, and that you are telling all people of color that we are stuck in a system that answers
that offers
no incredible social, economic, political, and the answer is yes.
You don't want to elaborate beyond that? So for myself, as in whoever the students of color, I don't know if there's a student.
Well,
we just have to deal with it as people of color.
No. What I'm saying is that the question is this where we are stuck? The answer is yes. And we are stuck there for a lot of very articulable, definable, historically validated reasons, and we have been unable to solve them.
Okay, for a couple of the panelists who want to try to work on some problem solving.
No.
Well, I think
let me just throw this other question in. It's from us. I think mm-hmm. it's from a student sure. as well. I'm not quite sure. Boulder sees itself as progressive and liberal, but continues to be primarily white. Look at this audience. I don't think there are laws segregating the community. How does this get changed?
Yeah, and I want to jump in right here because I live in Austin, who sees itself the same way. Mm-hmm. Incredibly progressive, really dynamic. And it, you know, but it really, when Ellen left, my person of color left me. Because my world was incredibly white because of the place that I live and the work that I do. And I swear to God, anytime we went somewhere, if we stood next to each other, we were going to wind up in a photograph in the newspaper. because we were going to be the only two colored people in the room.
And look, we've got a twofer. We what? Have a Hispanic, and we have the black chick. Whoa!
You know, and so to say that we're progressive, we believe ourselves so. Do I think we're stuck? We're stuck because you'd have to relinquish power. Who wants to do that? Who readily That's wants right. to do that? That is a tall, tall order.
Yeah, Del, thank you so much. I mean, this stuckness, and so I want to respond, and I really appreciate the question from the student. So this, to me, is now getting to a place that is a core of what we have to deal with. And it is uncomfortable for people. This is about power. Hegemony. And so let me tell you how I see it. And in the line of the stuckness. So I'm 63. As I told you, I grew up in segregation. I'm an affirmative action baby. I was one of that quota, which we have now gotten rid of, so that Dell would her 1% so that we could go to school. So I'm affirmative action into law school. And I have to tell you, the seething hatred I got from my other law school students who thought by me being there, I was reducing the prestige of their school in the elevator, in the locker, in the classrooms, in the halls. And I have to tell you, some of those people that were throwing shade my way are some of the stupidest people. I'm like, if this is what law school is, I'm sorry. This was a golden handshake for you. Because you ain't bringing nothing to this party. And so I've come through that. And this is my analysis. America, in the perception of the Trump personage, has basically said, white America has said, people, we have gone as far as we're going to go on the civil rights agenda. We gave you a black president. You got Beyonce and Jay-Z. You got LeBron. And actually, now what more do you want? Don't want my neighborhood? Don't ruin my Whole Foods by asking for okra? Don't do the, don't, you know, no. Don't. We have gone as far as we're going to go, and we're progressives that have gotten you there. Mm-hmm. It was the progressives that were the hardest on Barack Obama. And progressives would come to me and say, I don't know why he ain't closed Guantanamo. And I'm saying, well, when have the white presidents done that? I mean, it's like you don't even understand the cultural imperative that brings to us as black people, even though we disagree with him. You don't understand what that means to us, right? So essentially, this is about power. And at some point, as I tried to say in my remarks, it's a zero-sum game. Either our gain is your loss, or we come to this as a team. I live in California. We have been a majority. So in my office, we don't even use the term minority. We are retiring that term. Even though in places there are people that are minority, but nationally, in a blink, 2025, we're switching over to a majority people of color, which California has been now for 18 years. When you look at that, you will see what the difference is when you have a multilingual, multicultural, the majority is people of color. And so what has happened there is white folks have either learned to share power or they continue in a battle to try to hold on. And so let's be real here, folks. As the young people say, let's keep it 100. Let's keep it 100. That in fact, this is about a changing demographic. And the question is, how will we engage it? And right now, we are stuck. We are stuck because, as Dell says, who's willingly going to give up power when you have never engaged the reason why you got power in the first place?
I just want to... I just want to add the point I really wanted to make about my millennial daughter is that she's back in New York where she wants to stay. And when I go to visit her, her friends are all multiracial something or other. And I'm really looking to them to
figure this out,
to work it out. And for their children to get to a point where it'll start to make a difference for most of us, the train has left the station. There just isn't that much more than we can do But we can teach our children, our grandchildren, that what we did and what we failed to do, it's on them to do a course correction. And if we're not teaching our kids that, then we're failing all over again. It neutralizes the reason for even having a panel discussion like this. If you are not willing, if you don't do it, then who's going to? Where do they learn? They've got to be carefully taught.
So there are several questions that we've gotten from students, again, and I just want to make sure that we're providing students with some concrete things that they can do as well. So I'm going to read a couple of these, and if any or all of you want to answer these. So the first one, I am a student here in Boulder at Fairview High School. Thanks for coming, high schoolers. And our student body is 75% white. How can we address the issue of racial inequality when coming from an overwhelming majority of privileged white perspectives? Mm-hmm. Another question. How do we...
Pick me!
The lady in purple.
The woman of color.
Another similar question in the same vein. How do we talk with the... quote, uncomfortable white, unquote, people who are afraid to address race / intersectionality.
Yeah.
So what was the first one again?
The first one. So this is a student from Fairview High School. 75%. Our student body is 75% white. How can we address the issue of racial inequality when coming from an overwhelming majority of privileged white perspectives?
Okay, so being the Jewish mother that I am, back to Hannah, my daughter. When she was a freshman in high school, she was one of four blacks, one East Indian, out of a student body of 500. She decided to organize a black students' union. So in order for there to be a new group, a new organization at the school, it had to have a permission from parents. And all these white parents started getting this letter about allowing their precious little girl to stay after school for the Black Students Union. And one parent actually wrote back, there are no blacks in that school. As though you couldn't have a Black Students Union unless you had a whole bunch of black people. I mean, the organization did exist. She also started an Amnesty International chapter, which really got us into hot water because, you know, these people are very rich New Jersey types and they don't know about Amnesty or black students' unions, and they weren't all that happy about it. But that's what you do. You go on that limb. You don't be intimidated by the fact that you're one of a few. Dell, weren't you the first... First Spanish-speaking undergraduate to finish University of Texas.
In Austin.
She doesn't like to talk about that. James Bell will never talk about the fact that his organization was the recipient of a MacArthur grant. You keep on keeping on. You do what you know you ought to do, and the right people will follow you, and the rest you don't care about. Let them go. You do what you feel you must.
Thank you. Others?
Yeah, I want to speak to the students on the, I love the intersectionality question and the students in terms of we are a critical mass nation. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're a small minority, people, you know, we are the people that like it big. You know, we have the meats, right? You know, it's just that, you know, it's just got to be big. And I just think that, in fact, there are some responsibilities that you suggest. So one is, know your stuff. Two, advocate, but don't try to convince people.
Yes.
So when you are saying that we at a high school are 25% and 75%, understand the responsibility of knowing what it is that you, as your 25%, are wanting to be inclusive about. There may be allies about that, so be responsible about that part and be authoritative about what you're wanting. And never define yourself as, and we were able to convince people. Because there's just too many people in the human family for you to convince in that way. And some people will never be convinced. That should not be your mission.
And I would also say that as groups, we need to reflect on our own issues around power. Yeah. Because I think when I look back on going to UT and Latino students organizing and what they wanted to do, and ultimately two things happened. We were so fearful about the onslaught that we held on to one another so tightly that we made no space for anyone coming up behind us. And that two, even within that organizing, the shit between men and women and how power was organized and who got to make decisions was so overwhelming that we undid ourselves. And the ability to stop mid-fight to look inside at what was going on between us ended it. It dissolved a big part of our successful group. And so there is the need to also look within.
Right. Because taking a position is hard. Mm-hmm. That's why so many people are apathetic. Taking a position is hard. So if you want to, in a 25-75 position, understand what you're setting yourself up for. I'm not saying don't do it. I've done it all my life because I actually had no choice. I just could not watch it happen and not do anything about it, even though there were haters, right? And so essentially my thing is know what you want, keep your eye on the prize, keep going, and don't be discouraged by the fact that some people are throwing shade because they always will, and that's all right.
So kind of continuing on this, and Deliana, you started to touch on this a little bit with your response. I want to put in this question that addresses specifically women of color. Mm-hmm. So for whoever wants to answer it, but and it's another student question. What would you say to our women of color living in, quote, whitewashed, end quote, Boulder, who on a daily basis suffer with self-beauty and self-worth, who are reminded daily that beauty was never their shade of skin, and they're pushed down deeper in the dirt by black men comment, I believe is what the last one says.
Wow.
Yeah.
Boy, y'all bringing the real.
Yeah.
Y'all bringing it real. Should read it in louder, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you want me to read it again? Okay. What would you say to our women of color living in whitewashed Boulder who on a daily basis suffer with self-beauty and self-worth, who are reminded daily that beauty was never their shade of skin and pushed down deeper in the dirt by black men within the community? Some black men. I'll edit that a little bit.
So. I think at these formative ages, 18 to 21, are so hard. You're saying farewell to adolescence. You're saying hello to adulthood and finally having to confront what it means to be grown up. And if you're lucky, you've had someone along the way to say to you, you are wonderful no matter what. But, you know, you must arrive at a place where when you get up in the morning, you look at the mirror, in the mirror, and you say to yourself, I am somebody. I am important. I'm here for a reason. And I'm going to make it work for me. It is not easy. It is hard. But your survival depends on it. Trust me when I tell you, growing up in a black middle class family didn't mean squat when I got to Antioch College, where there were 1,500 students in 1958. And three blacks. Navigating that was a bitch. But what I had to do was remember why I was there and make friends. And I did not have the luxury of thinking, I can't be friends with you because you're white. What my daddy always told me was, there's no point being around white people all the time if you don't learn something from them. And at a school like this one, at a school like Antioch College, at Oberlin, at Swarthmore, at Vassar, at Yale, you learn who the people are that will network with you because you've only got 4 years to do it. And if you don't make the most of those 4 years in terms of establishing friendships and connections that can help you, and I'm not saying suck up to people because you think they can do you some good. I'm saying learn how to navigate that. Do not ever use your color as an excuse for not achieving.
Yeah, and I... You know, and I have to second what Ellen has said. I mean, if you have someone, if you find someone, if you are that person for somebody else, understanding, you know, I mean, not growing up in an environment where that was the case, you know, having a mom that would kind of look at me and go, if I did anything to that face, I'd have that nose worked on. But I got old and realized what my mother had gone through. And that what, you know, however twisted and unhelpful that was, you know, it came from her own experience. And it is that appreciation of someone else's experience at a moment much past when those were the words that were being said to me regularly was an important piece. And it really taught me then to look at how I speak elsewhere and when I don't carry forward and the messages I don't want to give my own kid. And, you know, really wanting to say to him, you know, buddy, you don't owe me squat. Keep going. You're doing a great job. So it is, it has to be within. It is has to be providing it for one another. It has to be seeking it at a place where you can get it well. And then it is not being washed away by those efforts to make you feel less than.
So we have 6 minutes left. I definitely want to get this question in. It was, I wrote your name on here, Deliana. So anyone who wants to answer it, but we definitely have to get this question in. This is from, it doesn't say it's from a student, so I'm assuming it's from a community member. There are few, and few is underlined, few Latinos or Latinx on panels at this conference. There is almost nothing about Mexico or Latin America. There is just one panel in Spanish, and that's on Friday. Does any panelist have any thoughts about this glaring hole? About the lack of Latinx representation at this conference.
How do you achieve that in this particular community? I mean, you know, you look around the room, there's not that many folks. So
I'm here because Ellen brought me here. It will be my move to try and identify somebody else that I bring. So as students who want to see that here, if this is really, if the statement that was made at the start, which is we want to not really defer to students, but we really want to give that special notice, then find someone and bring them and encourage them to speak and bring other students with you. Beyond that, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm sitting here and thinking, ooh, I have a friend in San Francisco who is a fifth generation Mexican, not Mexican American, because as we all know, once upon a time, the United States
was Mexico.
Was Mexico.
No, we don't all know that, but we should.
But it just occurred to me, he is the vice president at a Wells Fargo bank, and I will be in touch with him when I get back.
But I love that question because it is about movement. Mm-hmm. So you've seen it, you've identified it, you have the courage and strength to say that this is a deficit, and you want to make it an asset. And this is a life lesson that nothing happens accidentally. Remember, I was talking always about policy, power. Nothing happens by accident. So what happens is Ellen brought us. We're going to bring some other people. And that is how it happens. And essentially, folks that have put this together, I'm sure, aren't deliberately excluding people. We know who we know. And so now we will just continue to try to move in this way in order to make it so that it is more multiracial and multiethnic. And I can tell you, it will happen. Because then you get to the next iteration. So I live in California. We are very multiracial, multiethnic. So the next question is going to be, where are the Samoans? Then the next question is going to be, how come there ain't no Japanese? Why are we ape? I mean, and you know what? Don't get mad. Don't hate. Let's just, I mean, that's what it means. And then it's going to be, well, you're African American. Ain't there nobody from the Caribbean? I mean, it's just going to keep, and hey, what about the Ethiopians? Okay, let's just keep, I mean, because you can't, and that is why we always have to have these conversations about race. Because people don't want to actually have equity. They want to be comfortable. And what you have to say is every time there's a new level, it's like, oh, wow, I don't know. But it's not like, well, that's wrong that you asked me that and you're hating on our panels. Because no, it's the right thing. And let's just keep making it happen. Keep making it happen. Throw shade, but make shit happen.
Mm-hmm. Make shit happen.
And James, as I mentioned, I know a few black people.
Right, so that's right.
I could ask them. I swear.
No
brain. I swear.
So we have maybe a minute and a half left. I'm just going to go ahead and throw this question in because, it's easily a question that can be answered in a minute and a half. Even though reparations would only be symbolic, would it be a powerful step?
Did you write that from the back?
I did not.
That's from a community member. Right. Reparations.
Well, so that when I came to sit down with Dell and James earlier, it was one of the thoughts that I had, and it can seem simple and whatever. I used to sort of not be with the reparations notion, and I read Ta-Nehisi Coates's the case for reparations, and I still wasn't persuaded. But I don't know. I feel like maybe yes. That feeling is not particularly articulate or informed, but it just feels I punched through to another side, and that feels like it just might be right.
Right down the road from here is the Native American Rights Fund. If they can't get it, what hope do we have? I mean, I'm telling you, before I would take a penny, I would see to John Echohawk. You need it first, because you were here first, and you've been done wrong.
Okay, so we are out of time, unfortunately.
Can I just, can I get 1 minute? Just because I feel so, I'm Irish, so I tend to feel guilty.
No, that's
so I began with a real downer. So let me close with something. It's only going to take 1 minute. And as a bit of white privilege, whatever, let me, as one Irish, the one Irish white dude on the panel will read now a white Irishman's poem. But it was a poem circulated, got a lot of circulation on the night that Barack Obama was elected president. And it made me cry then. And for all of my pessimism and fatalism and, I remain hopeful. Here goes. Human beings suffer. They torture one another. They get hurt and get hard. No poem or play or song can fully right a wrong inflicted and endured. The innocent in jails beat on their bars together. A hunger striker's father stands in the graveyard dumb. The police widow in veils faints at the funeral home. History says, don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. So hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that further shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cures and healing wells. Call the miracle self-healing, the utter self-revealing double take of feeling. If there's fire on the mountain or lightning in storm and a God speaks from the sky, that means someone is hearing the outcry and the birth cry of new life at its term. Thank you.